Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 341, titled The Ties That Bind, Part Two. This is being recorded on December 16th of the year 2001, and it's more discussion about the events in and around the attacks of 9/11/2001. We are going to resume the discussion where we left off in side two, and that is with some of the Sudanese activities of Osama bin Laden when he was in Sudan in the 1990s. Now, that was one of the areas that he was operating in after he left Afghanistan, and one of the things we have not been told was the fact that he was working in Sudan on various construction projects, some of those financed by the Saudi government. And we also looked at information that the Clinton administration was not able to, for one reason or another, successfully utilize information about bin Laden that the Sudanese government was attempting to give them. We also looked at assertions that, in fact, elements of the CIA were deliberately developing disinformation and also providing misinformation to the Clinton administration. Who knows whether perhaps the Bush/petroleum faction of the agency was deliberately misinforming Bill Clinton, who had defeated the former CIA director, the elder George Bush. We're going to take a look now at another of Osama bin Laden's activities in Sudan, namely his work on behalf of a British firm, Hunting Surveys, and we're going to proceed from this particular element of the ties that bind. This article, once again, is from Vanity Fair's issue of January of the year 2002. This is an article by David Rose titled, The Osama Files. Speaking of the activities of Sudan in the 1990s, desperate for investment, especially to develop its vast reserves of oil, the government submitted to the stringent economic medicine prescribed by the World Bank, slashing inflation and privatizing state-owned industries. Osama bin Laden himself became the Sudan agent for the British firm Hunting Surveys, which plays a large role in oil prospecting and whose military division makes about a fifth of the West's Trident nuclear missiles. In 1994, it tried to assert its anti-terrorist credentials by assisting France in the capture of Erich Ramirez Sanchez, better known as Carlos the Jackal, unquote, the notorious Venezuelan-born terrorist who claims to have killed 83 people, now serving a life sentence in France. So noting the role of Hunting Surveys the arrest of Carlos the Jackal in Sudan, and also reprising an element that we looked at inside one of the program. This from the Los Angeles Times of Friday, December 13th of the year 2001, an article by David Zucchino, datelined Narbonne, France. This is about Zacharias Moussaoui, one of the suspects just indicted this past week. He was a French national originally from Morocco. This article is headlined, It's as if he had died, unquote, Mother of Suspect says, and that refers to his mother in France. Dealing with the French counsel for Zacharias Moussaoui, we read, skipping down, Zacharias Moussaoui is represented in France by Isabelle Constant Père, who is well known for representing and later promising to marry Erich Ramirez Sanchez, better known as Carlos the Jackal. Noting that his French counsel was also going to marry him, we're now going to take a look at who was helping to arrange the defense of Carlos the Jackal and who was vouching for him after his arrest in Sudan. Bear in mind the Hunting Services connection to SAME and also Osama bin Laden's work on behalf of Hunting Services in Sudan. For some background, we're going to begin with one of the elements that we concluded with inside one. We're going to be talking about a Swiss-born Third Reich operative, very active during the war and after the war, particularly after the war. This is somebody that we've looked at in, among other programs, For the Record broadcasts, or miscellaneous archive shows M19 and M21 about the fascist third position. We looked at this in For the Record program number 333, and in some of the other For the Record programs dealing with the remarkable encyclopedic book, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International. That book was authored by Kevin Coogan, last name C-O-O-G-A-N. I've interviewed Kevin many times in the past. This is one of the best books ever written about fascism, particularly about fascism after World War II. The volume was published in softcover by Autonomedia, Copyright 1999. And the book was edited, by the way, by WFMU on-air personality Dave Mandel. Now, of François Janoux, who was very active in helping Carlos the Jackal after his arrest in Sudan in 1994, accomplished in part through the auspices of hunting services, and bear in mind who was representing Carlos the Jackal, in France, a woman who is now representing Zacharias Moussaoui. This woman was going to marry Carlos the Jackal. Carlos's defense in France was arranged in part by François Janoux. In Dreamer of the Day, we read of Janoux. Janoux became directly involved in helping Carlos after the Jackal was arrested in the Sudan by French agents on August 15, 1994. Skipping down. After his arrest, Janoux publicly expressed his great admiration for Carlos, whom Janoux considered one of the, quote, heroes, unquote, of the Palestinian cause. Now, bearing in mind Janoux's support for Carlos after his arrest in Sudan in 1994, the fact that Zacharias Moussaoui and Carlos have an attorney in common, bear in mind that same woman, far from being an ordinary attorney, was going to marry Carlos the Jackal, which obviously would have permitted the ultimate in networking. We're going to review some information about François Janoux. This is from an appendix to Kevin Coogan's book, Dreamer of the Day. It's titled, Sheikh François, Friend to Hitler and Carlos the Jackal. And we're going to review some of Janoux's background, and this is only a small portion of his background. Bear in mind his connections to Carlos and the connection of that milieu to, in turn, some of the Al-Qaeda networks. On May 30, 1996, an obscure Swiss banker named François Janoux committed suicide in Geneva, Switzerland. From the brief mention of his death in the New York Times, one would not know that one of the most important figures in the history of 20th century terrorism had died. And how many men can say that they were friends with both Adolf Hitler and Carlos the Jackal? Skipping down after discussion of some of the SS operatives who went to work for the U.S. Intelligence apparatus after the war and their connections to Alan Dulles, in turn connected to the Bush family and also connected to King Ibn Saud, friend of Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, and the milieu that we analyzed in detail in For the Record 332. We read of Janoux, skipping down. Janoux, too, was in the thick of things, having established a friendship with SS General Karl Wolff, Himmler's adjutant, the leader of the German team in Italy that negotiated Operation Sunrise with Alan Dulles. By the way, parenthetically, that was the surrender of all German forces in Italy. Returning to Kevin Coogan's text. Shortly after the war, Janoux acquired the publishing rights to the works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. He also played a major, if murky, role in aiding fugitive Nazi war criminals. Another key player in the post-war Nazi underground resident in Switzerland was SD Colonel Eugen Dollmann, General Wolff's chief lieutenant in the talks with Dulles. Besides Wolff, Dollmann and Janoux had another friend in common, Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Janoux first met the Grand Mufti in Jerusalem in 1936 and again in Berlin during the war. Dollmann also maintained links to the Grand Mufti. By the way, the Grand Mufti's links running to Otto von Bolschwing, a key German intelligence operative in the Middle East before the war, who also went to work for Alan Dulles. His links, the Grand Mufti's, that is, also go to King Ibn Saud. His links go forward in time to people as seemingly disparate as Yasser Arafat, and even through the World Muslim Congress, one of the major Saudi-financed bodies that was involved with the anti-Soviet Afghan war of the 1980s, in which Osama bin Laden got his start as a warrior. Now, we're going to review some information about Johann von Leers, who in turn is associated with Ahmed Huber, and the Nazi emigre milieu in Egypt in the mid-1950s, operating under, initially, the auspices of Otto Skorzeny, and also operating in conjunction with the Grand Mufti. It was this milieu which helped to spawn in Egypt what I call Islamo-fascism. It should not be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as fascist, but there's a profound element within Islam that is, and we're going to talk about that right now. Returning to Kevin Coogan's text, in 1955, with the Grand Mufti's friend Johann von Leers helping to run Egypt's propaganda ministry and its all-important, quote, Institute for the Study of Zionism, unquote, Janu began to see Egypt as a base for the anti-French FLN independence movement in Algeria. He worked in Tangier with an ex-SS officer named Hans Reichenberg to create the Arabo-Africa Import-Export Company, which supplied the FLN with weapons. Arabo-Africa was actually a cover enterprise established by Werner Naumann's network and included Janu's friend, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht. By the way, Naumann was named by Joseph Goebbels to succeed him as propaganda minister. Continuing. In Damascus, General Otto Rehmer, Ernst William Springer, and an ex-SS captain and RSHA operative named Alois Brunner created another gun-running operation, the Orient Trading Company, or OTRACO, to ship arms to the FLN militants. By the way, Alois Brunner was one of Eichmann's top aides in the liquidation of European Jewry. Now, we've spoken about François Janu in the past, and in fact, we took a look at François Janu in considerable detail in For the Record Program 333. We took a look at his connections to a French-slash-Vietnamese attorney named Jacques Vergès, his close support for various Palestinian organizations, such as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, his connections also to organizations like the Bader-Meinhof Group, and to people like Ali Hassan Salamé, the leader of the organizer of the 1972 Olympics massacre. I would note that the Red Army faction, or Bader-Meinhof gang, included Horst Mahler, who in turn is now a key operative on behalf of the NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party, which is also associated with the American National Alliance, the parent organization that publishes not only the Turner Diaries, but also the book Serpent's Walk that I speak of often. The Serpent's Walk could be thought of as the Turner Diaries for the Bormann Group. And I would note that the NPD also counts among its associates Ahmed Huber, nay, Alfred Huber of Al-Taqwa, an associate of Omar von Leers, or Johann von Leers, in Egypt. Skipping down once again, and by the way, one of the people associated with the Bader-Meinhof group and Carlos and François Janu was a woman named Magdalena Kopp, who later became Carlos's common-law wife, and she was a member of the Bader-Meinhof group. Skipping down again, reviewing this section we looked at earlier, Janu became directly involved in helping Carlos after the Jackal was arrested in the Sudan by French agents on August 15, 1994. After his arrest, Janu publicly expressed his great admiration for Carlos, whom Janu considered one of the, quote, heroes, unquote, of the Palestinian cause. We're going to take a look at, and bear in mind that the woman who was going to marry Carlos and who was his attorney is the woman who is now representing Zacharias Moussaoui. That woman is Isabelle Coutant-Père, P-E-Y-R-E, and I may be mispronouncing that. We're going to take a look at another article from the L.A. Times of Thursday, December 13th of 2001. This is an article by Henry Weinstein and David Savage of the L.A. Times. It's headlined, Terrorist Suspects' Attorneys Face a Unique Daunting Challenge. We're going to hear about the connections of another one of the people who's going to be representing Moussaoui. This is one of the people who's going to be representing him in the United States, in addition to Gerald Zirkin, the federal public defender in Richmond, Virginia, who was assigned to defend Moussaoui. We also read in this article, skipping down, on Wednesday, Zirkin learned that U.S. District Judge Claude Hilton, Chief Judge in the Eastern District, had appointed Edward McMahon Jr., 40, his former law clerk, to be co-counsel on the case, skipping down. Earlier this year, McMahon, who was a fundraiser and volunteer for the Bush campaign last year, was one of six candidates to become the U.S. attorney in the district where Moussaoui is being prosecuted. So a fundraiser for Bush, George W., that is also going to be representing Mr. Moussaoui. We're also going to take a look. We're going to return to the article, The Osama Files, by David Rose, in the January 2002 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. We're going to take a look at the identity of one of the people who was acting as an alleged go-between for the Sudanese government and the Clinton administration, rather. Beginning in the autumn of 1997, they, meaning the Sudanese government, made use of another private go-between, Janet McElligott, a lobbyist who had worked at the White House under George H.W. Bush. One wonders, perhaps, and I'm being facetious, why those connections didn't go through. I would also note that Linda Tripp, among others, was working for the Bush White House. She was the last person to see Vince Foster alive. And as I've noted, in connection with the destabilization of the Clinton administration, there are reports in the book Gideon Spies that Monica Lewinsky had connections to right-wing elements of Israeli intelligence. The Israeli right, like most of the Palestinian movement, or at least a great deal of the Palestinian movement, has links to what I call the Underground Reich and international fascism. I would note that the reprisals for the Osama bin Laden organized attacks on U.S. embassies in Africa in 1998 involved a cruise missile attack on a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan. This earned Bill Clinton not only the ire of the left, but also a lawsuit, as it was allegedly mistaken, and there were no connections between that plant and terrorism. Again, in light of some of the elements involved in providing faulty intelligence to the Clinton administration from the Sudanese government and or frustrating those, it's worth contemplating the destabilization of Clinton against the background both of the bin Laden presence with all of its connections in Sudan and some of the evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of François Genoux and the Underground Reich, forward to the Mousawi family, and some of the connections that I've already detailed. I would note that the attacks on the embassies in 1998 took place as the impeachment proceedings were gathering steam. Returning once again to the article about Mousawi in the L.A. Times of December 13th of 2001, article from the front page about his mother's statements about him. Aisha Mousawi said a French intelligence officer called her in late 1999 and said her son's name was in the address book of a man named Yannick who had died fighting for the Muslim cause in Bosnia. Well, in the past, we've dealt with the Islamic fundamentalist connections of the president of Bosnia, Alija Izetbegović, who as a young man fought in the 13th Waffen-SS Division, the Hanjar Division, a Bosnian Muslim Waffen-SS Division recruited by the aforementioned Hajamin al-Husseini. We've also taken a look at the aforementioned Egyptian physician, Mr. al-Zawahiri, who is one of the main mentors to Osama bin Laden and, according to some accounts, the real mastermind of al-Qaeda. There was mention of al-Zawahiri, who grew out of the Islamic fundamentalist milieu in Egypt that was associated with the elements of the Underground Reich, such as Genoux, the Grand Mufti, Johann von Leers, Ahmed Hubin, and others. The Financial Times of Monday, December 10th of 2001, had an article by Hiba Saleh in Cairo. This is headlined, Smuggled Book Sets Out Story of Terror. It quotes, it's by Herb Saleh in Cairo, and it quotes al-Zawahiri about the effort against the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 1980s. This is when Osama bin Laden got his genesis as a warrior, and bear in mind the role of the World Muslim Congress in this. Bear in mind also that Bosnia was a key area of operations for al-Qaeda. Quote, in the training camps and on the various fronts where fighting against the Russians took place, Muslim youths received a deeper understanding of the conspiracy that was prepared against the Islamic world, unquote, writes Mr. al-Zawahiri. These youths, he adds, went on to revive the Islamic duty of jihad, or holy war, in Chechnya, Bosnia, and Kashmir after the Soviet Union withdrew in 1989. We're going to take a look now, bearing in mind Alija Izetbegović's youthful connections to the Hanjar Division. We're going to take a look now at alleged al-Qaeda connections to another part of the former Yugoslavia, namely Kosovo. We're going to read from the L.A. Times of Saturday, December 15th of 2001. This is an article by Lisa Getter, Josh Meyer, and Chuck Neubauer. It's Dateline Washington and headlined, Two U.S.-based charities funds held. And skipping down, The action came as NATO-led peacekeepers and United Nations police raided Global Relief's offices in Pristina, Yugoslavia, and detained several people on suspicion of being linked to international terrorism, according to a North Atlantic Treaty Organization statement. Pristina is in Kosovo. One of the things that we looked at in, among other programs, For the Record 161, we reprised this in For the Record number 293, is the fact that Alija Izetbegović, as a young man, a member of the 13th Waffen-SS or Hanjar Division, had as his sort of bodyguard, or the Praetorian Guard of the Bosnian Muslim leadership, an Islamic formation specifically named after and modeled after the Hanjar Division. It was called Hanjar. This, again, was the Praetorian Guard, so to speak, of the Bosnian leadership. It served as a special forces unit and assisted other Bosnian Muslim fighting formations. It was led and trained, as we looked at in For the Records 161 and 293, by Afghan and Pakistani veterans of the war against the Soviets. That information, by the way, from a book called Some Call It Peace by Yosef Badansky. We're going to take a look now at an interesting recent arrestee, so to speak, in Afghanistan. This from the New York Times of Thursday, December 13th of 2001. This is an article by Douglas France. It's headlined, Alliance Captures Australian Man Fighting for the Taliban. A 26-year-old Australian drifter who has been fighting alongside the Taliban was captured over the weekend by Northern Alliance troops, Australian authorities said today. David Hicks was a soldier of fortune, his father Terry said, skipping down. Terry Hicks told Australian newspapers that his son became a fighter with the Kosovo Liberation Army in 1999 and later a student of Arabic and Islam in Pakistan. As we looked at in the aforementioned For the Record 161 and 293, part of the heritage of the Kosovo Liberation Army was the 21st Waffen-SS Division, or Skanderbeg Division, another Muslim Waffen-SS, a Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS formation, but this composed largely of Kosovar Albanians. That from an article by Chris Hedges from Foreign Affairs magazine of May and June of 1999. We've also looked at the fact that the Hanjar II, the Afghan and Pakistani-led bodyguard of Alija Izetbegović, was engaged in force projection into Kosovo, Albania, and Macedonia in the early 1990s, and the possibility of networking, and again the ties that bind between Hanjar II, of Afghan and Pakistani genesis, and the Kosovo Liberation Army, heirs at least in part to the 21st Waffen-SS, should be borne in mind. Terry Hicks, perhaps, one of those people whose networking has provided him with, or David Hicks, rather, with, once again, the ties that bind. We're going to listen to a short section now from RFA program number 22. You're going to hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
The segment we're going to read next is from a book entitled The Patriotic Traitors, The History of Collaboration in German-Occupied Europe, 1940-45, by David Littlejohn, published by Doubleday & Company, 1972. This section is headlined, A Man of God and Friend of Hitler. The spiritual welfare of Soviet citizens of the Muslim faith was in good hands. It was the charge of no less a personage than His Eminence, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin el-Husseini. There can be no doubt that he took his responsibilities seriously. An indefatigable worker in the cause of Allah and Adolf Hitler, he toured prisoner of war camps exhorting the faithful to take up arms on behalf of the new order. He reviewed Muslim SS units, their field gray uniforms topped with a fez. He blessed weapons, consecrated standards. He won over a distinguished Tartar poet, Musa Jalil, who agreed to serve on an Idel Ural Tartar committee, which had as its object the establishment of a Muslim state on the banks of the Volga. Idel is the Tartar word for Volga. Nothing ever came of this scheme. Jalil later had second thoughts and tried to back out. For his pains, he was court-martialed and shot by the Germans. The Grand Mufti himself, however, readers will be relieved to learn, came safely through the war.
That again from RFA 22, recorded in July of 1986. Now, jumping from the past to the present and bearing in mind the Grand Mufti's efforts on behalf of the Third Reich to organize Muslims and people from the former Soviet Union in order to, basically to gain control of the oil-producing region of the former Soviet Union in the Caucasus and other areas that are now Muslim areas of the former Soviet Union. We're going to read an article from the New York Times of Friday, November 9th of 2001, an article by Amy Waldman, datelined Kazan, Russia, headlined, Russia's Muslims Unchained But Still Chafing. Skipping down, we read, from 20 regions of Russia and bordering nations, they, Muslims, have made their way to an institution whose very name was unthinkable a decade ago, the Russian Islamic University. Founded in 1998, the university already has 148 students in its newly refurbished building. It also has the support of a former communist who rules Tatarstan, the semi-autonomous republic centered around this urbane city on the Volga River. Skipping down. The madrasa, that's this school, reflects a younger generation's view that Russian Islam, shaped by accommodation to Tsarist and later Soviet rule, is not worth preserving. The school's director, Malik Ibragimov, 36, who studied in Saudi Arabia for 4 years, said fundamentalist Islam is the only Islam. And apparently some of this Wahhabism, which is the Islam preached in the Soviet Union, is once again taking effect, or is having an effect, which perhaps was, as I spoke in For the Record program number 334, what von Paulus's Sixth Army was meant to do, was to capture Stalingrad, the key to the Volga River and the Caucasus and the Soviet oil-producing regions. New York Times of Sunday, December 9th of 2001, has the following article by Michael Wines, datelined Urus Martan, Russia. It's headlined, War on Terror Casts Chechen Conflict in a New Light. This reflects back directly on For the Record programs 182 and 329, among others. In fact, the three hitchhikers were coming to join a group of militant Muslims that had established a paramilitary beachhead inside Chechnya. As in Afghanistan, some were outsiders and members of the strict Wahhabi branch of Islam. Skipping down. The size of the terrorist element is unclear, even to people in Urus Martan, which many call the center of Islamic extremism in Chechnya. On the one hand, the Wahhabi takeover here, like much of the Chechen war, was clearly propelled by outside support. Residents say the Wahhabis also had ties to a notorious training camp that indoctrinated Chechens and foreigners alike in Islamic militancy and military tactics. There are strong indications that the camp and its leader, a guerrilla from the Middle East known as Khattab, have ties to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Perhaps clearest of all, Chechnya's guerrillas are indisputably financed by a web of Islamic charities, banks, and other organizations that have served as cash conduits for terrorist groups. And of the Wahhabi presence in Chechnya, we read Mr. Itslayev, and he's now an editor of the local paper, that's Abdul Itslayev. Mr. Itslayev, the hitchhiker of 2 years ago, is deputy editor of the Urus Martan newspaper, Marosho, or Freedom. He said the town's first Wahhabis arrived in 1997, not from abroad, but from Dagestan, Khattab's one-time home. Skipping down. Foreigners arrived only later, both Mr. Itslayev and Urus Martan's deputy administrator, Lyoma Goysotanov, said, quote, I myself saw Ukrainians, Lithuanians, Arabs, and Azeris, Mr. Goysotanov said. They had the most expensive cars, Lincolns, four-wheel drives, and the most expensive weapons, which even the Russians didn't have, unquote. The foreigners also had money, handing out $200 and automatic rifles to young Chechens who joined them. By mid-1998, civilian opponents were being murdered. In mid-1999, the foreign fighters staged a coup. Urus Martan's militia was replaced by Wahhabis, and the civil court was abolished for a tribunal that adopted Sharia, the legal code of Islam based on the Quran. Girls were shooed from school and women were ordered to wear veils. Alcohol was banned. The group left Urus Martan to join the August 1999 invasion of Dagestan and then returned to take power. By late 1999, he said, there were 2,000 Wahhabis, others estimated as many as 7,000, quote, only one word would fit here, Mr. Itslayev said. It was a mob, unquote. and perhaps, I would say, that apparently Al-Qaeda-linked element, and certainly Wahhabi-linked, perhaps the heirs to some of the Muslim formations formed by the Grand Mufti. This concludes, for the record, 341, The Ties That Bind, being recorded on December 16th of 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.